Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The Islamic State group is fortifying its ranks in the Iraqi city of Ramadi as government forces plan a counteroffensive. The U.S.-led coalition overnight focused on the IS stronghold of Mosul and the town of Baghdadi. An Al-Hura journalist tells VOA IS fighters have surrounded Baghdadi and Haditha west of Ramadi on the road to Syria. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi told the BBC Ramadi will be retaken from the militants in days, not weeks, a statement which got reaction from the U.S. Secretary of State. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
Carter, speaking on CNN Sunday, said the Iraqi army was not outnumbered, but in fact vastly outnumbered the opposing IS force. He said that raises a question about the willingness of the Iraqis to fight the Islamic State group and defend themselves. The defense chief expressed the hope that given the proper training, equipment, support, and time, the Iraqis will develop the will to fight. An Iraqi lawmaker quoted by the Associated Press described the comments as unrealistic and baseless. He attributed the loss of Ramadi to a lack of good equipment, weapons, and aerial support. Defense Chief Carter also says while the U.S.-led airstrikes are effective, there is nothing the U.S. can do to substitute for the Iraqi forces' will to fight. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
A Tunisian soldier opened fire on his fellow troops today, killing 7 and wounding 10 before being shot and killed himself. Authorities say the attack happened at a base in Tunis, not far from where 2 Islamist gunmen opened fire, killing 21 tourists in March. A UN-brokered peace conference for Yemen, scheduled for later this week, is in doubt, with Yemeni officials saying the talks have been postponed. Yemen's president, Abdurrabur Mansour Hadi, in Saudi Arabia, is demanding Houthi rebels withdraw from territories seized before talks proceed. The UN has not confirmed the postponement. This is VOA News. Malaysia has found 139 suspected migrant graves. The chief of police in the country says the graves believed to contain the remains of migrants have been found near the country's border with Thailand, and that some graves contain more than one body. National Police Chief Khalid Abu Bakur told reporters today the graves were found at 28 suspected human trafficking camps that likely housed 20 to 300 people per camp. Bakur said the recovery teams are in the process of exhuming and conducting autopsies on the remains.
To bring out the remains is another problem, another big issue for us. So we are making all the arrangements now to on how to bring out all the remains respectfully.
Thousands of people have been smuggled from Myanmar and Bangladesh into Malaysia and Indonesia through Thailand. The UN Security Council is condemning the killing of an opposition leader in Burundi, shot to death Sunday in the capital. Zedi Feruzi of the Union for Peace and Development Party has been shot and killed with his bodyguard, and his death has stalled the efforts to bring all sides to the table for talks. Meantime, aid agency Oxfam says refugees from Burundi are streaming into Tanzania by the thousands. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
The new arrivals in Tanzania crowd the beach at Kagunga on the shore of Lake Tanganyika, waiting for transport to another refugee camp. Oxfam communications officer Amy Brown says the influx is putting a strain on humanitarian agencies.
Currently now at the refugee camp, there is overcrowding, and also as aid agencies struggle to get enough equipment to respond to the needs of the new arrivals.
The most urgent need, she says, is shelter to accommodate families, many of whom are now staying in churches and schools. Clean water is also needed, as well as the tanks and purification chemicals needed to store and treat it. The United Nations Refugee Agency has already reported 3,000 cases of cholera, with up to 400 new cases each day. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rescue workers in the central U.S. states of Texas and Oklahoma searched today for 12 missing people believed swept away by rampaging flash floods. Already the flooding has left 3 dead and destroyed at least 400 homes, and the state of Texas has declared an emergency in 24 counties. President Barack Obama laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns as part of his observance of the annual Memorial Day in the United States. Speaking at the ceremony, Mr. Obama remembered the men and women who died to secure the U.S. liberty and keep its citizens safe. The ceremony at the Arlington National Cemetery was attended by dignitaries, military personnel, and families of veterans, while many communities across the country are marking Memorial Day with parades, patriotic concerts, and ceremonies. Others will do so with quiet reflection on those who lost their lives in service to the United States. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The aid agency Oxfam says more than 70,000 refugees from Burundi have crossed the border into Tanzania, fearing political violence at home. Aid agencies are seeking more support as disease and overcrowding take a toll on the refugee population.
That's VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. Details coming up also in the news. In Ethiopia, voters went to the polls yesterday to cast their ballots in general elections. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the UN Security Council has condemned the killing of an opposition leader in Burundi whose death has derailed efforts to resolve the country's crisis through UN-sponsored negotiations. Zedi Feruzi of the Union for Peace and Development Party was buried yesterday, a day after he and a bodyguard were shot to death in the capital Bujumbura. In a statement late yesterday, the Security Council condemned his killing and another deadly attack in Bujumbura last week. It called on authorities to try to prevent further violence while also respecting the freedom of expression and assembly. The Security Council urged leaders to take part in political negotiations, but opposition leader Frederic Bamvugani Yamvira said earlier yesterday that his party can no longer hold talks with the government. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has condemned Feruzi's murder and is urging all parties to shun violence and work to resolve the crisis. Burundi authorities have violently cracked down on anti-government protesters who are rallying against President Pierre Nkurunziza's re-election effort. Last month, he announced he will seek a third term in next month's election. Critics say a third term would be unconstitutional and violate the two-term limit. Mr. Nkurunziza insists he is eligible to run again because Parliament, not voters, elected him to his first term in 2005. His plan to run for another five-year term has plunged Burundi into its worst crisis since a 2006 peace deal ended more than a decade of civil war. The aid agency Oxfam says more than 70,000 refugees from Burundi have crossed the border into Tanzania, fearing political violence at home. As VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, aid agencies are seeking more support as disease and overcrowding take a toll on the refugee population.
Most of the new arrivals in Tanzania are women and children. They crowd the beach at Kagunga on the shore of Lake Tanganyika, which borders both Burundi and Tanzania, waiting for transport to another refugee camp. Oxfam communications officer Amy Brown, working in Tanzania, describes desperate conditions at Kagunga.
It's a very thin strip of beach that's about 800 metres long, and behind it is a high mountain. So it's very, very cut off, basically. It's rocky, sandy beach, and people are living right on the beach all the way down to the water, waiting.
Most of the refugees who have crossed the border in the past 3 weeks have been relocated to the Nyarugusu camp through another transit centre. Brown says the influx is putting a strain on humanitarian agencies.
Currently now at the refugee camp, there is also overcrowding as the camp is above its capacity, and also as aid agencies struggle to get enough equipment to respond to the needs of the new arrivals.
The most urgent need, she says, is shelter, tents to accommodate families, many of whom are now staying in churches and schools. Clean water is also needed, as well as the tanks and purification chemicals needed to store and treat it. Health is another major concern. The United Nations Refugee Agency has already reported 3,000 cases of cholera, with up to 400 new cases each day. Driving this refugee crisis is a pervasive sense of fear, as thousands flee from a volatile political conflict in Burundi. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial bid for a third term has prompted massive street protests, deadly clashes with the police, and an unsuccessful coup attempt. During the weekend, an opposition leader was assassinated in the capital, Bujumbura, and at least three people were killed in a grenade attack. Brown says when asked why they have fled, refugees typically give one of two responses.
The first one is that people have either received direct threats to themselves or their family members, or report that family members of theirs have been killed. And then the other group of people say that they're fleeing almost preemptively. They feel like war is about to start, to use their own words, and they want to get out before that happens.
Agencies working on the ground, including Oxfam, have jointly asked for $91 million in funding to address the growing crisis in Tanzania up until September. More than 26,000 Burundians have also fled to Rwanda, and nearly 10,000 have crossed into the Democratic Republic of Congo since April. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Ethiopia, voters went to the polls yesterday to cast their ballots in general elections for the 547-member parliament. The government says over 36 million potential voters registered for the election. Over 50 opposition parties took part, including a new group popular in urban areas called the Blue Party. The opposition, which was only one sitting member of the legislature, says the outcome is not in doubt. The ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPRDF, will likely win big. Government critics say the opposition has been harassed and its organizers arrested. Press groups say the government has continued to jail reporters and shrink the already small independent media. On the other hand, ruling party supporters say the government has delivered about 10% economic growth with what have become with hydroelectric dams, new roads and railways. Brahanu Naga is a professor of the economics department in Bucknell University in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. He is a former deputy chairman of the Coalition for Unity and Democracy. He was elected mayor of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia's 2005 elections, but never assumed the post. Instead, Brahanu was jailed with several other opposition leaders for protesting voter irregularities. Reporter William Eagle asked Mr. Brahanu his view on yesterday's polls.
Ethiopia, really, by any measure, is one of the handful remaining totalitarian states, in the sense that it is a state that wants to control every aspect of life of the people who live in that country. In that sense, it is really, we have never seen this kind of stuff since the fall of the Soviet Empire. So to think that there would be any meaningful election in an environment of suppression, especially since 2005, where no room for free expression exists, people cannot really have any meaningful discussion on their country's affairs, especially if they are critical of this government. Journalists cannot write. Civil society institutions have been destroyed. In that environment, any election worthy of its name can take place. This is not an election that would have any meaning whatsoever to reflect the interest or expression of the Ethiopian people.
Dr. Naga, would you agree with some who say that despite the authoritarianism, the ruling party is delivering on economics enough so to keep people pacified?
Well, there are two questions here. In the first place, the presumption that the economic growth that is claimed is true. And related to that this economic growth is somehow distributed to reasonably equitable. This was that people would have or are presumed to have a decent or a better life, to say that this government has delivered in those economic issues. If that was truly believed, then what would the government be afraid of? Why shouldn't it allow a free and fair election? They know that this is a government that is totally rejected by the population of Ethiopia. They know that. In 2005, they thought that they have, somehow delivered economic things, because they believe their own propaganda. They believe that, and they opened up, and they knew right away that in a free, democratic environment, they cannot survive as a regime. The fact of the matter is, actually, people are economically significantly worse off. A few people are making a killing. They take land for free. They take, government resources to build, buildings in the middle of the city, taking land away from other people, and they built houses, or they build business buildings. Now, you know, the common eye would see that and say, well, look, there is some development. Well, if there is development, if there is development that people could see, then why don't you let people choose? They would choose their pocketbooks, right?
Do you think there's any chance for the Blue Party to make any sort of advance?
Well, I actually believe that what the government would do, if there is any mild intelligence left, and I think that's what some of their, at least more experienced ones, would probably suggest, is all this pressure is coming from the international community because we have only one opposition seat in 547-seat parliament. Therefore, we need to allow a few more seats. Maybe they would increase this 10, 15, whatever number comes to their mind. That's what they probably would do, knowing full well that that would not make a difference.
Do you see any evolution or any new direction for the opposition? Should they tweak their strategy? Should they change their strategy in any particular way, in your opinion?
Oh, many opposition groups have been tweaking and changing and adjusting their strategies. One thing that has become absolutely clear now is that there is no possibility for any peaceful change in Ethiopia for a real democratic dispensation. That much is now clearly agreed. Now, what organizations would do, starting from there, what kind of actions they would take, what kind of strategies they follow, of course, depends on each organization. But that is now a clear consensus, that this is not a regime that would simply change by waiting elections every 5 years.
That's Birhanu Nagga, professor of economics at Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. In response to opposition critics, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Hailemariam Desalegn, says his government is democratic with opposition campaigning and televised debates. He says each election is better than the preceding ones. He told Al Jazeera that economic growth has also been democratic and based on grassroots support. Hailemariam estimates the country will need between 10 and 20 years to eliminate extreme poverty. He suggests that international press and rights groups are pressing a liberal and westernized agenda that does not necessarily apply to Ethiopian democracy. Residents of Beni, a town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, are on a tax strike following a series of massacres in the area. Local activists have called for the strike until security is restored. Nick Long has more from Goma in the Eastern DRC.
Civil society groups in Beni Territory say the death toll from killings and massacres in the area since last October is now well more than 300. The United Nations believes Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels are mainly responsible for these atrocities. Government troops and UN peacekeepers have been engaged in heavy fighting against the ADF, suffering casualties but inflicting heavy losses on the rebels. The slaughter of 20 people in a suburb of Beni 2 weeks ago was the signal for another wave of protests. Citizens held demonstrations and stayed away from work for a week. The president of civil society groups in Beni town, Gilbert Kambali, then announced a change of tactics. He said for humanitarian reasons people should go back to work as they could not afford not to, and instead they should show their discontent by refusing to pay taxes. A spokesman for civil society in North Kivu province, Gento Maundu, told VOA the tax strike is nearly a week old and is continuing.
Les taxes ne sont pas payées pour l'avancement, les taxes sur l'étalage. Il y a aussi des patentes, ce n'est pas aussi payé.
He says the taxes that are not being paid are stallholder fees and some larger taxes paid by businesses to the DGI, the General Tax Office. He said some better-off individuals in Beni, who are more dependent on the government, are still paying taxes to the DGI, but many other business people are not. A local journalist in Beni told VOA that most of the big annual taxes had already been paid for this year, and so far no one has been arrested for refusing to pay tax.
Les acteurs ou les actifs de la société civile sont menacés. Il y a des coups de téléphone anonymes.
Mandu says the civil society activists who called this protest have been threatened in anonymous phone calls and even directly in meetings, and he and his colleagues are very worried about this. Gilbert Kambali told VOA threats have included death threats against himself and six of his colleagues. He has asked the authorities to investigate the threats, he said, but without result. Meanwhile, as fear grips the area, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says 3,700 families have fled their homes in the past 3 weeks, most taking refuge in Beni and nearby towns. Some aid organisations have suspended their activities in the high-risk areas of Oicha and Eringeti north of Beni, but the UN Office says some aid workers are now going back to those areas. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The number of Ebola infections has risen in Guinea despite downward trends in two other West African countries. Police in Guinea say the sudden increase to 27 new Ebola cases in a single week stems from the illegal public transportation of dead Ebola victims by family members. A police captain in Conakry says some people are taking the corpses of family members in taxis or hiding them in cars to avoid police detection. 11 of the 27 new cases were reported in Dubreka, where some of those attending a family funeral in mid-April fell ill. The bodies of Ebola victims are highly contagious. Rural customs requires that families show respect for their dead by washing them before private burial. For the last 15 years, Plymouth, England has held a symposium on obesity. It's estimated that more than half the city's adults are overweight or obese, and the rest of Britain is not faring much better. But what's happening in the UK can also be seen in the US and in many Western countries and in a growing number of developing nations. One obesity expert says it's a long-term problem that is very difficult to solve. VOA's Jordi Capua reports.
Professor Jonathan Pinkney says no one health issue has the most impact on human health or engenders more debate about how to tackle it than obesity. Pinkney, a professor of endocrinology and diabetes, took part in the annual Plymouth Symposium on Obesity, Diabetes, and Metabolic Syndrome on May 21st. He says obesity is a complex issue that involves more than calorie intake.
I personally feel that this is such a wide field. There's so many issues. There's politics, there's biology, there's everything you could imagine. There's the food industry. And I think that sometimes we're all a bit guilty of just maybe concentrating on one of those areas. And you could go to a conference anywhere in the world where they spend days just talking about bariatric surgery or fizzy drinks. So I think it's right to talk about everything under one umbrella.
Bariatric surgery restricts how much food a person can eat, sharply reducing caloric intake. The professor gives his definition of obesity.
When body size becomes so huge that it impairs people's day-to-day function and quality of life and well-being and personal relationships, you know, that's kind of devastating. That tends to occur at a higher level of body weight.
However, Pinkney says those not considered technically obese are also at high risk for poor health.
That's the more important point for the health of the population. You know, all the diabetes and heart attacks and cancers and things. I mean, that's really caused by lower levels of weight gain. As you can see, it's just the average weight of the population drifting up because we're just sort of eating the wrong things and not really sufficiently active.
The Plymouth Symposium showed that much is known about the biology of the brain and appetite control. But Pinkney says, as one speaker pointed out, knowledge is not enough.
That is completely overridden by things going on around us in the environment, food advertising, food industry, the way that it's all marketed to everybody, including children. And I think the simple fact of the matter is, you know, our bodies are very smart and beautifully built, but it's just that the biological systems that would keep us slim are just completely swept away by the pressure from the things going on around us.
And he says it's difficult to do anything about it, whether in Britain, the U.S., or developing countries that have adopted a Western diet heavy in sugar, salt, and fat.
There's a multinational food industry, and there's huge vested interest in selling a lot of the stuff. I can't give you a magic word as to how you crack this, but we've got exactly the same problem here, And I think you can prescribe all the drugs you want. You could do all the bariatric surgery you could manage to fund, but it's not going to crack the problem unless you stop the development of the epidemic at source.
Going to the source means how eating habits are formed. Poor eating habits can be a learned behavior passed down by parents to their children.
I think a lot of things start very early in life. You know, it's difficult to break the habits of a lifetime, isn't it? I think we all find that. But I think our health and our prospects for the future are kind of laid down fairly early. And I think that's not surprising. Big kids often have big parents. I think they learn this at an early stage.
Solving the problem, he says, is a lot harder than simply trying to encourage prevention.
There isn't a kind of medical way to prevent the problem. It really does look as if it's down to politics, policy, marketing, food industry, and preventing children from being exposed to all of this. And I think that's the toughest thing that we face in the world. It's very, very difficult.
Professor Pinkney says too many unrefined carbohydrates, sugars, are to blame for much of the obesity epidemic. He says they do not satisfy a person's hunger for long, and people eat their next meal sooner.
Commercially produced, processed food with large amounts of carbohydrate, sweeteners, short-acting carbohydrate, and it just sets us up to fail. I think there are big problems with carbohydrate in the Western diet.
While it may be difficult to foster better eating habits, Pinkney says there is precedent for a large-scale behavior change.
Other things have changed. I mean, one really interesting thing, I think, was what's happened over cigarette smoking and how people complained about not being able to smoke in pubs and restaurants and have to go outside. But it didn't take very long for that to translate into clear health benefit. So, you know, maybe you can get these things through in time, little by little.
Some lessons, he says, can be learned from our hunter-gatherer ancestors.
The hunter-gatherers, you know, going right back to last ice age and before that, would have had a diet that was rich in complex sort of fiber-type carbohydrate. You know, there would be protein in it now and again, but it didn't have all the sugar. So the diet that is, of course, followed by traditional peoples is radically different.
He says studies of indigenous peoples who returned to their traditional diets took a step back from modern health problems. Pinkney says a combination of prevention methods, medical interventions, and political will be needed to stop the obesity epidemic. In the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says over 35% of adults, or nearly 79 million people, are obese. More than 17 million children are obese. The annual medical cost of obesity in the U.S. is nearly $200 billion. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Security Council has condemned the killing of an opposition leader in Burundi. And in Ethiopia, voters went to the polls yesterday to cast their ballots in general elections for the 547-member parliament. Coming up, music from Algeria. And in our feature segment, students in the U.S. engaged in an open discussion about police brutality and racial tension. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Good evening, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning with basketball.
Yehiz, let's tip off with the National Basketball Association playoffs. The Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors appear headed to a showdown in the NBA Finals. Both clubs took commanding 3-0 leads over the weekend in their respective conference series and now need only one victory to advance. In the Eastern Conference Finals Sunday night, the Cavaliers scored a 114-111 overtime victory over the visiting Atlanta Hawks. Cleveland superstar LeBron James turned in another sensational all-around performance. LeBron scored a game-high 37 points, grabbed 18 rebounds, and passed for 11 assists. Yes, VOA basketball fans, if you're keeping score, the man nicknamed King James turned in another royal triple-double, double figures in 3 different statistical categories. Cleveland's head coach David Blatt described LeBron's Game 3 heroics like this.
Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. I've never seen a stat line like that in a playoff game or many other games, to be honest with you. It's not just the stat line. There's a lot more than that, you know. LeBron cramped up, and he knew that we could not win the game without him, and he you know, he played through pain, and he played through the cramping. He just wouldn't let us lose. Just would not let us lose.
Meanwhile, LeBron James had this to say about his outstanding performance.
I gave it everything I had tonight. My teammates did, played our tail off, and, you know, to be able to win a game like this, you know, with so many ups and downs and so many lead changes, it's a huge win for our team.
As I mentioned, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers are now only one win from advancing to the NBA Finals. It would be LeBron's 5th consecutive appearance in the NBA Finals and his 2nd with the Cavaliers. In the 2007 NBA Finals, LeBron and the Cavaliers were swept by the San Antonio Spurs in 4 straight games. LeBron James was early in his NBA career then, though, and he's now a much more experienced and dominant player. And it looks like LeBron will soon be going against Stephen Curry and the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals. Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, has also been prolific in the playoffs with his extremely accurate long-range shooting. The Warriors can advance to the NBA Finals later Monday night with a victory against the host Houston Rockets in Texas. Let's take a break now for this important message from a Congolese giant who will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame on September 11th.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
This is the Voice
of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma covered an Athletic South Africa invitational meet over the weekend in Cape Town, and he filed this report.
With his sixth and final attempt, Rocco van Rooyen broke new grounds with a massive throw of 85.39 meters in javelin to qualify for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China in August. Van Rooyen is elated at bettering his lifetime best from 80.56 meters a fortnight ago.
I'm just overwhelmed at the moment because I was definitely not going to compete until late last night. I was still going to withdraw, and I asked my Western Province manager, and she said, no, it's at least take one throw because the TV is going to be there. So I said, okay, I'll do one. And then after one, I thought, okay, maybe one more, and then six, and then this happened. So I'm feeling very good, and my knee is not 100%, but I'm very happy at the moment.
So why did you want to withdraw, and yet today you've done your two best?
Yes, because I'm going to the IAAF Diamond League in New York on the 13th of June, and I wanted to be on my best there. But I was struggling this whole year with throwing too high, so I thought maybe I'll just take it, if I at all compete, as a training session to throw lower.
From 80 to 85, did you expect to come this far?
To be quite honest, yes and no. I knew that if my angle was going to be better, there's going to be a 6 meter increase because the people tell me that all the time. But I'm for 4 years already throwing very fast with my arm, but height is a big nightmare. So I just kept the point low. I tried the other times as well, but still it didn't work. But today something clicked, and I think if it can click again, I'm looking really much forward to the future.
That was Rocco van Rooyen, the South Africa javelin champion, speaking in Cape Town. Meanwhile, on the track, South Africa's Wade van Niekerk triumphed in 200 meters in a time of 20.58 seconds. He is positive that the best in him has yet to come.
It was nice. I enjoyed it. I really hoped it was a bit warmer, because when I came out of the bend, my legs felt a bit jelly. I couldn't push as hard as I wanted to. I'm just happy it was a positive result.
It's your best time this season. I'm sure it gives you a little more confidence that your 44.91, you can improve on that.
I definitely have higher goals for myself and want to do better. It's all about growth for me right now.
Well, higher goals both in 4 and 200, or just in one of them?
Both.
That was Wade van Niekerk, South Africa's 400-meter champion. I'm Mark Omer in Cape Town, South Africa.
VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman Shagun Dot on the spot. Adeyemi joins us now with a package of sports news. And Shagun kicks off with Liberia football.
Good evening, Africa. Liberia can host international soccer matches again. So says African soccer's governing body, CAF, after Liberia was declared free of the deadly Ebola virus. CAF, however, said Guinea and Sierra Leone remain bad for the same reason of the Ebola epidemic. The decision to lift the ban on playing international matches in Liberia comes just weeks before the start of the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifiers. Liberia's first home qualifier is scheduled for September against Tunisia. Guinea and Sierra Leone will still be forced to play their home games outside of their respective countries, with new cases of the virus still being discovered. Morocco has agreed to stage the home qualifiers of Guinea, but the plans of Sierra Leone are yet unknown. In more African football news, Frenchman Hervé Renard has stepped down as coach of African champion Ivory Coast. In February, the charismatic 46-year-old led the Elephants to their first African title since 1992. Renard is now tipped to take over at French top league side Lille. Let's now turn to athletics. Kenya's Gladys Cherono smashed the course record at the 10-kilometer IAAF Gold Label race in Ottawa, Canada, on Saturday. Cherono's personal best of 30 minutes 56 seconds on a windy night was good enough to eclipse a record of 31 minutes 21 seconds set by fellow Kenyan Mary Keitani a year ago. The victory fetched Cherono the $8,000 prize money, plus $2,000 for the course record, and another $2,000 for being the first athlete, male or female, to cross the finish line in a special gender challenge. The women were given a head start of 3 minutes and 25 seconds, and no one ever caught up with Cherono. In the men's race, the 2009 course record set by Ethiopia's Deriba Maga, which is 27 minutes and 24 seconds, was never challenged. Kenya's Nicholas Ball won in 27 minutes and 55 seconds, 2 seconds ahead of compatriot Simon Cheprot, who finished second. Staying with athletics, course records also fell at another event on Saturday, a half marathon in the Czech Republic. Elijah Tirop Siren led the Kenyan quartet to victory and took 20 seconds off the course record to win the men's title. Seren broke away from the leading group with 4 kilometers left to achieve what he described as the best win of his career in 61 minutes and 1 second. In the women's race, Mulu Seboka of Ethiopia won in 69 minutes and 11 seconds for a personal best and a course record by 6 seconds. Finally, the stage is set for the FIFA presidential election, scheduled for Friday, May 29th. The election is being contested by 2 candidates, incumbent Sepp Blatter, who is 79 years old, and challenger Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, who is 40 years younger than Blatter.
I've been in football for a number of years and on the executive committee of FIFA the last 4 years. And after talking to colleagues from across the football world, and I'm talking about fans, players, as well as member associations, I think that we all agree that it is time now for a change, to have a FIFA, a transparent FIFA, to work on the sport itself, on development. I cannot see myself being a member of the executive for another 4 years under the present circumstances, and I'm willing to take the challenge.
2 other candidates, Luis Figo of Portugal and Michael van Praag of the Netherlands, have withdrawn from the race. Analysts have tipped Blatter to retain the presidency, which he first assumed in 1998. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yeheyas Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, students in the United States engaged in an open discussion about police brutality and racial tension. And next, researchers using agricultural byproducts to build inexpensive homes with a low CO2 footprint. But first, music. From Algeria, here is Idir and Nadia with Amon Per.
femme, c'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi, que je t'aime. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Face à ton destin, n'oublie jamais que le respect sera toujours comme la racine de notre famille. Tu es ma fille.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit. C'est pour toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève. C'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Tu sais, bah, il y a des choses entre une fille et son père qui ne se disent pas chez nous. Mais une chose est sûre, c'est que tu m'as toujours dit de respecter les autres et de travailler dur. Dur pour aller toujours plus loin, toujours plus haut. Et tu m'as rendue citoyenne du monde.
Parce que Ziram se veut d'être l'homme libre, tu porteras ce nom comme on porte le destin. C'est un peu de moi, même si je ne te le dis pas. Je suis entre tes mains comme l'eau sacrée d'un pays. Citoyenne de ce monde, ta vie sera ma vie.
Que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses.
À mon père,
cet homme libre, loin de sa terre, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine. C'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père.
Idir and Nadia from Algeria with A Mon Père. The violence and unrest across the United States in response to the death of several individuals while in police custody, as well as police-involved shooting deaths, is more than just a trending news item for students at Ladue Middle School near St. Louis, Missouri. It is the central focus of one class that has students engaged in an open discussion about police brutality and racial tension. VOA's Ken Farbo has more.
What happened after?
In his second floor classroom at Ladue Middle School in the St. Louis suburbs.
Throughout St. Louis, we then had this whole movement, right?
Vincent Fluellen is teaching a lesson more immediate than algebra and grammar.
For people, for black folks, this has been happening for some time.
It is a lesson in life through the eyes of his students.
The events of Ferguson and Mike Brown's death just in our backyard, you know, they are our neighbors. There was no way that I could just kind of go with the course as previously had done.
If someone is running away from you and they're not like dangerous, but you need to catch them, like shoot them in the foot or something, not like kill them.
Fluellen says his multicultural studies course can no longer just cover topics like foreign foods and immigration. It's the latest and recurring headlines that drive more of the curriculum and conversation with his students.
It has been mind-blowing, the number of reports in which it seems to be yet another, you know, Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, you know, Eric Garner, I mean, Tamir Rice, I mean, just numbers, countless numbers.
Fluellen believes his classroom is in many ways the only place where these students of different races and backgrounds can openly share their feelings, concerns, and questions about the events happening in the world around them.
Kids have questions. Kids look to us to help shape their understanding of the world in which they live. I get to do that without interjecting my own personal thoughts, but I can help facilitate a conversation.
It is the kind of conversation University of Missouri St. Louis professor Brian Hutchison says many have shied away from because of its sensitive nature.
Over generations, it's become a taboo subject where we don't feel like we have the facility
as individuals to talk about it in a way that is not harmful or that is constructive or that might not make us feel like that we are in peril.
What percent of all Americans think that race relations are worsening?
Flewellen says his class at the moment is not an elective. He says while some parents have voiced concerns about his teaching and the way in which he portrays some of the recent high-profile police incidents, the class is growing in popularity among his students.
Those who are not in this class certainly wish that they were in the class.
Flewellen says his wish is for this kind of class to appear in more schools throughout the country, in the hopes it could lead to less turmoil and unrest and greater understanding between police officers and the communities they serve and protect. Kane Faribault, VOA News, St. Louis, Missouri.
Researchers using agricultural byproducts to build inexpensive homes with a low CO2 footprint. The British developers now offer houses made with bales of straw. That may not surprise many Africans, but these builders say they will also build houses of hemp. VOA's George Putish has more.
Wheat straw is abundant and cheap and has excellent thermal properties, but its load-bearing capability is not great. However, combining it with wood beams and panels provides a sturdy construction material that is a good thermal insulator with a small carbon footprint. These houses in Shirehampton near Bristol, England, have bricks only on the outside. Their structural and dividing walls incorporate straw, which provides better thermal insulation and lower energy expenses than traditional brick construction. Head of the Department of Architecture and Civil Engineering at the University of Bath, Professor Peter Walker, says straw also lowers the amount of carbon dioxide being released into the atmosphere.
As a plant, through photosynthesis, it actually absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that carbon dioxide is effectively stored within the straw.
Walker says straw walls also have excellent fire retardant properties.
One panel that we used, which was rendered with lime onto the straw, actually had a fire resistance of 2 hours and 15 minutes before we stopped the test. So, in fact, it's remarkably resistant to fire.
After milling flour, Britain's farmers are left with about 7 million tons of wheat straw annually. Half of that is discarded. As the average three-bedroom house needs only about 7.2 tons, the agricultural waste could be used to construct more than 500,000 new homes. Another alternative building material, a mixture of chopped hemp core and lime, soon may find wider use as an insulator. 7 to 8 times lighter than concrete, the so-called hempcrete is an effective and affordable filler for wooden frame walls, suitable for low-rise houses. It is natural, easy to mix and clean, and also lowers the building's carbon dioxide footprint, says director of Hemp Lime Construct, Alex Sparrow.
Even accounting for the production of the lime and for the transport and the energy used on site, there's 160 kilograms net of atmospheric CO2 locked away in every cubic meter of hempcrete wall.
Researchers say natural-based building materials provide safer, chemical-free environments and may lead to substantial reduction of energy expenses for homeowners. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States pauses each year to honor those who died in its defense through military service. The custom is an ancient one, recalling a speech by the Athenian statesman Pericles that the casualties of war are worthy men, and the living need not have a more heroic spirit. On Monday, May 25th, Memorial Day, in communities across America, there will be speeches striking similar themes, and a moment of silence will be observed. Like the poppies in Flanders Fields, small flags will be seen among the graves in the nation's many military cemeteries, and the families of the fallen will stop to remember. Beyond mere ceremony, the day represents a debt paid by the living to those Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice to ensure their country's freedom. Some died in battle, some of disease. Others were lost in foreign prisons and never returned. Most died very young, defending their nation's ideals and liberties, perhaps even before they had much of a chance to fully appreciate them. Hundreds of thousands died fighting to make others free, too, in North Africa, Europe, the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. Memorial Day honors no single battle or war. Its meaning transcends heroic monuments. Rather, it is the recognition by a grateful nation that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.